Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent update to share with you. As you probably know, this podcast is made possible by the generous support of listeners like you. And with our financial year ending on June 30th, we're facing a $52,000 gap in funding that must be closed by this date. With just days to go, generous friends of the ministry have now offered to match every dollar given towards this goal up to $10,000. So please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for joining us on the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And do register there for a chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you are on Instagram or TikTok, please do check us out at Premier Unbelievable. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform so that more people can hear about it. But now for today's show. In this episode, we're going to be hearing something a little bit different from normal. In November 2022, Ulster University hosted the first international academic C.S. Lewis symposium to be held in Northern Ireland. The event, called Now We Have Faces, was hosted by the C.S. Lewis group at Ulster University in coordination with English at Ulster, and they very kindly let us broadcast the talks on this podcast. What you are about to hear is the second part of his talk. If you missed the first half of Malcolm's talk last week, then do check out episode 158.
I think probably the greatest example, certainly in our time, of the poet whose eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, glances from earth to heaven, that is to say, starts with the absolutely embodied and particular, but writes about it in such a way that their particular account of the particular opens itself, it's kind of roofless, it opens itself up to body forth or to connect you to a whole series of apprehensions that you know you've had and would otherwise have missed. So the first poem that Heaney wrote that he felt was a satisfactory poem, and which is the poem that opens his first volume with Faber at any rate, Death of a Naturalist, Digging, is an exact example of that. I mean, he starts for a moment with the problem of writing, you know, between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, you know, snug as a gun. And then he appears to be interrupted in his high-minded pursuit of the literary, sitting in the upstairs room with the window half open, trying to be the poet, you know, in this farmyard in the north. And, of course, what he's interrupted by is the sound of digging and the sound of the spade in the gravelly earth, and he looks down to see his father digging potatoes. And then he looks deeper, and he sees his grandfather cutting turf on Toner's bog. And he brings you into the particularity. You know, he talks about the feel of the potatoes in the hands, and when he gets to the digging, he says, you know, the squelch and slap, the curt cuts through peat, you know, and the wonderful piece of bravado, you know, my grandfather could cut more turf on than any other man on Toner's bog, and he remembers taking the milk to him. So you're reading this poem, and, you know, going down and down for the good stuff, there's the grandfather. And if you're an Englishman like me, who loves Ireland and visits and has enjoyed, but you're thinking, well, thank you, Seamus, I really get a feeling for a spade now. I know what digging's about. Oh, look, there's another three lines about digging. I'm there, I've got it. Is there anything else? And suddenly, magnificently, in a kind of coup de théâtre at the end of that poem, there is. He says, but I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. And suddenly, as soon as you read those lines, I'll dig with it, you revisit every account of digging in that poem. And you find it has embodied certain things you knew or half knew or begin to apprehend about writing. About writing as being about not the surface, but going down and down for the good stuff. About cutting through living roots. About the two purposes of the digging that he describes, the potato digging to feed, to nurture, to nourish, and the digging for the peat to warm, to bring the focus to the hearth. Suddenly, all those things have become powerful emblems of what poetry is at its best. And it's all opened in that final phrase. I'll dig with it. His eye glances from earth to heaven, if you like, if we stand heaven as meaning the otherwise invisible, the otherwise only apprehended but never comprehended, the so-called airy nothing that might slip away, is bodied forth and given a local habitation and a name. Now, for a long time, I'd only read that as being about poetry, but about 16 or 17 years ago, when I began to work on what became the book Faith, Hope and Poetry that came out 12 years ago, I was rereading this Shakespeare text, but now thinking about this in light of theology, in light of a theology of the incarnation. And it occurred to me, and here I have to make a confession, I thought this was an original thought. I mean, I'm not sure there are any really original thoughts. I think there are thoughts which are generous and generative, and we kind of all go to the same place to have the thought. But I thought this was an original thought. I was reading this passage of Shakespeare, and I was going, what does it remind me of? It reminds me of something. This thing about heaven, earth, earth, heaven, about the gap between them. This thing about bodies, imagination, which should be the heavenly word, bodies. This thing about local habitation and a name. What is this? How did I get there? What's the connection? And suddenly it dawned on me that Shakespeare was, with kind of grace and a certain amount of irony, since it was supposed to be set BC, Midsummer Night's Dream, that he was riffing on the prologue to John's Gospel. He was riffing on the great account of incarnation, where you remember in the beginning of John, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the same was in the beginning with God. And it's all going round up there. You can't see it. You can't hear it. It's in the realm of abstraction. And as you're reading it, you're thinking, I'm sure this is great philosophy, and if I knew a lot of great philosophy and theology, and there's some Greek philosophy in there, and you're kind of, but like, you don't get it. You're just kind of reading through and thinking, help me here. And then suddenly you get to verse 14, and this logos you've been hearing all about, that was anarche, it was in the beginning, suddenly you hear the words, and the Word was made flesh, and dwelt, had its habitation, dwelt among us, and then a little bit longer, and we beheld, we saw it, the poet's eye to see, we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And I suddenly went back to the Shakespeare and thought, what if he's actually saying, look, what we poets do is only a little reflection of the thing the great poet has already done. We poets want to body forth our meaning and can only get it there if we're using making a real visible, tangible, touchable, living body for it. And the more living and local, habitation it is, the more likely it is to body forth the universal. There isn't a quarrel between the particular and the universal, you know. And what if Shakespeare was deliberately touching on that and saying, well, we're doing this because we're made in the image of a maker. As Tolkien later put it, we make still by the law by which we're made, he says in Mythopoeia, the poem. So here was I thinking, oh, wow, this is beautiful. There's a whole theology of poetry, there's a whole theology of imagination here. Oh, I could get a book out of this. Anyway, so there I was, you know, thinking about that. And I thought it was my insight. So you can imagine the little shock of recognition when, during the beginning of the pandemic, I reread this book, which I'd read when I was in the sixth form and read again when I was an undergraduate. But, you know, it had gone so deep inside. I thought my idea that there is a direct parallel between the theology of incarnation on the one hand and the making of a poem on the other. I thought this was my idea. And there am I, reading a book I know I read several times in my youth. And he says, poetry too is a little incarnation. giving body to what had been before invisible and inaudible. The whole kernel and seed of a theology that I tried to open out had all been there in C.S. Lewis after all. So at least, the very least I can do is acknowledge my debt to this honest Ulsterman recognize that he'd sowed a seed. But we can still reasonably ask the question, I think, how did Lewis himself get there? And that itself is part of the story of his conversion. And in the story of his conversion, the story of the integration in Lewis himself of his two great faculties, the two great faculties for coming to know things that we all have and that he had absolutely in spades, and that is reason and imagination. Now, readers of Surprised by Joy will know the famous passage in which he talks very eloquently about the joy he had in the vision of northernness, very appropriate for this setting, and the Norse mythologies and the voice crying, Balder the beautiful is dead, and all these glorious things that he was reading and was deeply moved by. But in the end, they were a kind of cheat. They were, as he said in the famous conversation with Tolkien, which changed everything on Addison's Walk, he said, they're lies, even though their lies breathed through silver, to which Tolkien replied, they're not lies. And there began the great change that led to Lewis's own conversion. So he famously said, in Surprised by Joy, looking back at his intellectual life and imaginative life in the 20s, such then was the state of my imaginative life. Over against it stood the life of my intellect. The two hemispheres of my mind were in the sharpest contrast. On the one side, a many-islanded sea of poetry and myth. On the other, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I loved, I believed to be imaginary. Nearly all that I believed to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. I mean, he's put his finger on something. It's not just himself. He's put his finger right on the horrible split, the kind of epistemological apartheid we've all been subjected to, that there's so-called objective facts out there which are completely value-free, and the universe is just stuff, just an agglomeration of stuff to do things with. And insofar as there's any beauty or music or love or yearning or value, that's all just subjective. It's just in here. It's not as real as the concatenation of atoms outside. That's a split, you can argue, went back to Descartes, that Descartes' split between res extensa, stuff out there, and res cogitans, stuff in here. And we're all still, you know, our great-great-great-great-grandparents, you know, ate sour grapes, and our teeth are still set on edge by that split in ways of knowing. Lewis is just a very finely articulated example of it there. He had to struggle to get out of that. Now, we might look back on that and say, well, he was writing that in Surprised by Joy, another book of the 50s. You know, what evidence do we have about what it was really like for him at the time? Well, luckily, we do have evidence. We have this extraordinary poem, which in Walter Hooper's collected poems of 1964 was titled Reason. Lewis never published it in his own lifetime. Hooper doesn't date it. And I couldn't believe, after I'd read it at depth several times, that it could possibly have been called Reason, that Lewis would never have given it that title, because it's about a balance and tension between reason and imagination. And to title it Reason would be to upset precisely the poise of the dilemma that the poem is about. I thought if he'd give it a title at all, it would have been Who, because he'd asked the question, who will reconcile? Luckily, before his death, I had a chance to talk to Walter Hooper about it. And I said, you know, look, was that Lewis's title? And he said, no, it was just on a piece of paper. It had no title at all. But I gave it the title Reason, because reason comes in the first line. And I thought it was more about reason than not. But so I said, oh, what a relief, you know, because I don't think it's just about reason at all. So we know this was written sometime before his conversion. The content of the poem makes that clear. I thought it might have been written about, say, 28 or 29, but actually Alice McGrath thinks this might have been written as early as 25 or 26, in which case he was living for about 5 years with the question posed by this poem. And it's a question that I think many people are still having to live with. And it's interesting to see how Lewis put it and how he answered it, or how God answered it for him in the end. And it takes you a little bit further in his development of the word imagination. You say, looking back, he says, nearly all I loved I believed to be imaginary. Nearly all, you know, I believed to be real. I thought grim and meaningless. So he's got that standard imaginary versus real, which is what would have been the split if I'd said imagination and bodies. Yeah, he thinks that they're different. He's not yet, according to this backward look from Surprised by Joy, ready to think of the imagination as a truth-bearing faculty. This poem takes us inside that, but it actually suggests that he is beginning to be ready to see a balance and poise, even though for the moment it feels like an opposition between reason and imagination.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that this podcast is made possible by the generosity of friends like you. And right now, we're facing a $52,000 funding gap that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June 30th. Generous friends of this ministry have offered to match every dollar given up to $10,000. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now. Your gift will help keep important conversations like this one coming to listeners like you. Closing this gap in full by June 30th is vital. So please give your best gift today, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
Let's look at that poem. And it's an extraordinary poem. I mean, the extended metaphor is to think of ourselves, each person, as like the ancient city of Athens, with, on the one hand, the Acropolis, the Parthenon, the perfectly beautiful geometry and exact mathematics of that aspect of Greek culture. But as you know, I mean, there's a great book by Kitto called The Greeks and the Irrational, and there are the Eleusinian mysteries, and there's all the kind of the sort of other aspects of Greek religion and faith. And he uses that as an analogy or a model for what it's like to be a person. And let's just hear the poem and we'll see what he does with it. So it's a fantastic poem. So, set on the soul's acropolis, the reason stands, a virgin armed, commercing with celestial light. And he who sins against her has defiled his own virginity. No cleansing makes his garment white. So clear is reason. But how dark imagining. Warm, dark, obscure and infinite, daughter of night, dark is her brow. The beauty of her eyes with sleep is loaded, and her pains are long and her delight. Tempt not Athene. Wound not in her fertile pains Demeter, nor rebel against her mother right. Oh, who will reconcile in me both maid and mother? Who make in me a concord of the depth and height? Who make imagination's dim exploring touch ever report the same as intellectual sight? Then could I truly say and not deceive, then wholly say that I believe. I mean, it really is an astonishing poem. I mean, there's a huge amount to say about it, and I'm already running out of time. I suppose the first thing one ought to remark on, in terms of, we've rightly had some rebuke today to the sort of caricature Hollywood version of Lewis as this kind of crusty old Don in the tweed jacket. I mean, he did wear cheap tweed jackets, of course, but, you know, this crusty old Don who's all repressed and, you know, can only get on with men, and, you know, there's a little sort of boys' club of the Inklings, and it takes the feisty American woman to open him up and get him in touch with his, you know, emotions. And it's all complete specious nonsense, but if you wanted evidence of it, here's Bachelor Lewis in this male-dominated Oxford, trying to talk about his inner life and figuring or bodying forth the two elemental powers of the soul in reason and imagination, figuring them both as goddesses, as Athene, the goddess of wisdom on the one hand, and Demeter, a goddess of fertility on the other. And saying, how do I meet? I mean, if I could sum up what Lewis is saying in this poem in contemporary language, what Lewis is saying is, my problem is I can't get my inner goddesses together, which is not what you expect from the crusty old male, you know, male pale and stale, as we heard earlier on. I can't get my inner goddesses together. This is really serious about it. These are living powers in the soul. And the great cry is, who will reconcile in me both maid and mother? By this time, he's already intuited that reason and imagination have a kind of parity. They're both goddesses. On the one hand, tempt not Athene. That is to say, if you know something is, if you see logically that something is the case and you know something to be true, don't for convenience or as a sop to your longings or as a piece of propaganda for someone else, don't say that they're not true. Don't call truth untruth. If you know that 2 and 2 is 4, let it be 4, even if it be far more convenient for you if it were 5. He who sins against her has defiled his own virginity. No cleansing makes his garment white. He was partly holding off from Christianity because he wanted to be true. And if Christianity is not the case, even if he longed for it to be the case, he would be sinning against Athene. But of course, he's coming to realize more and more that Athene is actually on the side of Christianity, because the Logos is the divine reason and has put the divine reason in us. But having said, tempt not Athene, he has now admitted that Demeter, the imagination, is not just about the imaginary, but is about the whole way we understand the world. So wound not in her fertile pains, Demeter. Fertile pains is just incredibly powerful language, because of course he's therefore thinking about labor pains, the actual pains of fertility and giving birth, and he's seeing that as part of something that every creative person and writer goes through, as well as every mother. But also he's using the word pains in the sense of taking pains over a piece of work, really working on it to see it's right. You know, the proper long labor, in the other sense of the word labor, of literary birthing. So, wound not in her fertile pains, Demeter, nor rebel against her mother, right. He's beginning to get a sense that these are two complementary ways of knowing, and yet they, in his culture, in modernity, they've been utterly opposed. But he recognizes their ways of knowing. And it's interesting, he assigns different senses to them. He assigns sight to reason, seeing a thing clearly. And he assigns touch to imagination, this exploring, her exploring touch. It's wonderful. But he needs to know that if anything is going to be the case, and clearly what's in question here is Christianity, is whether he's going to believe Christianity or not. If he is to believe Christianity, then it has to satisfy both reason and imagination. And you kind of want to come up to him. You know, I understand they have pantomime on this stage. There's a point at which you want to say to Jack here, he's behind you, Jack. He's asking this big question. Who could possibly reconcile in me both maid and mother? Who make a concord of the depth and height? And he's almost echoing the language of that great blessing that Paul gives in Ephesians to the new believers at Ephesus, that ye being rooted and grounded in love may be able to comprehend, that key word out of the Shakespeare, with all the saints, what is the breadth and length and depth and height, and to know the love of Christ which passeth knowledge, that you might be filled with all the fullness of God. The very frame of the question is beginning to gesture towards Christ. So, for that matter, is he saying, who will reconcile in me both maid and mother? Well, hasn't he yet guessed that there's only one faith in which somebody is both a maid and a mother? through whom the divine imagination, as he's later to call them, is bodied forth and given a local habitation and a name. Now, I'm sure many of you, all Lewis scholars and fans, will know what followed, how he had that famous walk round Addison's Walk with Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, and in which they talked about myth, and he was talking about his delight in all these stories of dying and rising gods and Balder the Beautiful. And then the subject turns to Christianity, and Lewis is resisting both Tolkien and Dyson, a Catholic and an Anglican, Anglo-Catholic, walking along with him. And he says, I don't see what difference the life and death of somebody, you know, in mere factual history, you know, back there, would make to me. You know, well done, Jesus, bully for him. You know, why should this episode, if it happened in history 2,000 years ago, even if there was a resurrection, what difference does that make to me? It's just another item in the catalogue of things that have happened. And Tolkien says, Jack, I don't believe you're saying this. You've just been talking about how immensely moved you are by the mythic resonance of a death and resurrection God. And he says, yeah, but that's myth. That's beautiful to move my imagination, you know. And this is fact. And then Lewis says, can't you see that myth has been made fact here? Can't you see that all the great stories that have ever moved your imagination have now been bodied forth into this thing, which is absolutely properly accessible to your reason and part of history? You know, crucified under Pontius Pilate, you know, and when Quirinius was governor of Syria. It's in the realm of history. And yet the events have mythical resonance and never lose their mythical resonance. And you can almost feel the two hemispheres of Lewis's mind that had been so divided coming together in the course of that walk. And what they come together around is the figure of Christ. And you get that later in his essays like The Poison of Subjectivism or the essay, you know, Myth Made History. Somehow, the answer to that question he'd written in a poem possibly years before, who will reconcile in me both maid and mother, who make a concord of the depth and height? Who, we might say, connect heaven and earth, earth and heaven, and body them forth, and give to them a local habitation and a name? And the answer to that question was absolutely Christ. And I think all of Lewis's writing after that event is drawing from that beautiful fusion, the kind of energy released in the fusion at last of reason and imagination, a way of finding them to work together rather than pull against one another. And when we had the great celebration in 2013, the 50 years after Lewis's death, and he was finally honoured in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey, there were two lectures, and I was giving one and Alison McGrath was giving the other. And I was supposed to be talking about Lewis and the imagination and the apologetics, if you like, the imaginative appeal, imaginative apologetics account that was there in Lewis's fiction, in the Narnia books and in the Space Trilogy. And Alistair McGrath was supposed to be talking about Lewis's appeal to reason, you know, the rational arguments, the trilemma and all that sort of thing in Mere Christianity and the Problem of Pain and so on, and miracles. And we both immediately came up with a difficulty. We ended up phoning each other about it. I realized that some of the best rational arguments for believing in Christianity are embedded deep in the Narnia stories, like the whole business in The Silver Chair, where he basically rewrites Plato's myth of the cave and, you know, the question about what's real and what isn't and whether the round lamp is only there because there's no sun, but, you know, the sun is a projection of the round lamp, or Aslan is a projection of the cat or not. There's that. So he's appealing to reason. Meantime, Alistair McGrath was realizing that every time Lewis had a really strong rational argument to say that at least you weren't tempting Athena, you weren't going against the truth. There was a rational case to be made for Christianity. Lewis almost always bodied it forth with a brilliantly imaginative illustration. And so we ended up saying to each other, we can't divide this. These two things are mutually enfolded. And in fact, their mutual enfoldment was itself expressed very pithily in a single sentence by Lewis in the weirdly named essay, Blue Spells and Flalanspheres. You know, there's a whole story behind the strangeness of that name. But there he says, Reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the organ of meaning. The two things are mutually enfolded. But I have to say that I think once he was converted to its reliability as a mode of knowing truth, that it would begin to report the same as intellectual sight, although not, of course, in the same language. Lewis moved more and more deeply into the imaginative. But it was the imaginative, we're going to have to miss out lots of things, but I'll end it. It was the imaginative, not in the only the imaginary made up disembodied, but the imaginative understood as that which is always seeking body, form, and a local habitation and a name. And if you think of the great images of goodness, which is so hard to write about. Philip Larkin was once asked why he always writes depressing poems, and he said, well, happiness writes white, meaning it's like you're writing with a white pen on white paper. There are no contrasts. It's very difficult to describe, you know, what the hymn calls solid joys and lasting treasure. Lewis does it abundantly again and again. He does it, you know, not only in the golden goodness of Aslan, but the kind of lovely domesticity of the beaver's house in Beaver's Dam, you know. Or, you know, again, in the community of St. Anne's on the hill in the Space Trilogy. He's very good at that. And it's always particular. It's always embodied because he'd learnt what he says finally in such extraordinary and beautiful summary sentence in Reflections on the Psalms, for poetry too is a little incarnation giving body to what had been before invisible and inaudible. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. We were hearing there from the Reverend Dr. Malcolm Guite. He gave that presentation at a C.S. Lewis symposium called Now We Have Faces. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And do register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating it and reviewing it on your podcast platform. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.